This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Countries in the region have been working around a legal process that enforces prohibitions against child marriage.
That's Nan Ondidu with Plan International on the status of girls in Africa. Details coming up also. Hostages held in Mali have been freed. And the United Nations World Food Program has won the 2020 Nobel Peace Prize. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Mali's government late Thursday announced the release of four hostages held by militants. They are Malian politician Soumaïla Cissé, French aid worker Sophie Petronin, Italian priest Pier Luigi Mascali, and Italian bike trekker Nicola Ciaccio. Last week, Mali's government freed over 100 prisoners, which sparked speculation of a prisoner swap for Petronin and Cissé. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinot in Paris for more.
What we know so far is that four hostages were released on Tuesday, according to the Malian presidency, who tweeted the news yesterday after the hostages were released and arrived safely in Bamako, the capital. They had a brief talk with the transition authorities in Bamako before leaving the country. And we know that the French hostage, Sophie Petronin, arrived this Friday around noontime, local time here in Paris, to be greeted by the French president. We also know that one of the main Malian politician Soumaïla Cissé was among the four hostages who were released. And we also know, and that's something that was kind of a bit of a surprise, that two Italian hostages were also released. And among them, you have a priest who was abducted back in Niger, and also someone who was biking and discovering the, northern Mali, and who was kidnapped in early 2019.
Nico, it had been anticipated that there would be a press event with French President Emmanuel Macron. That did not take place. So what can you tell us about the reaction in France to Sophie's release?
Well, there will be no official comment this Friday by the French president. You're right. He greeted the French hostages in Paris at the airport. He talked to her privately. And also, there was supposed to be this official statement. You had everything ready. The microphone, the press was waiting for a statement from President Emmanuel Macron and from the French hostage. But nothing came. We know on Twitter before the hostage arrived by plane that the French president said that it was a huge relief for this liberation for the French hostage. And also he wanted to thank the Malian authorities for their work on this case. And also he said the fight against terrorism in the Sahel should continue. So it's a little bit of disappointment here in France that the hostage hasn't talked officially since she arrived. But we know yesterday she talked to the press when she arrived in Bamako and when she also met the political authorities, the Malian, their transition authorities in Bamako. She said that, and especially her son, who was fighting for her release for 4 years, because she's been held hostage for more than 1,300 days, and you know, he was doing a lot of kind of get her release. So she was really happy that her son was here next to her to fight for her release. And she also said, and that's something that was a little bit surprising to hear for French audience, that she hoped that she would be back in Mali. You know, she spent 25 years in Mali, especially in northern Mali, in Gao, to help with malnutrition, local population. And she said that, you know, she will get some rest. But according to her, she might go back to Mali even after what happened to her.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinot in Paris giving us an update on the hostages freed by militants in Mali. Sunday, 10-11, is the United Nations International Day of the Girl Child. It is a time to set aside to focus on the well-being and empowerment of girls everywhere. In Africa, as elsewhere, girls have made some progress in areas like health, education, and new legal frameworks that protect them. Still, challenges remain. To get a brief overview of the overall status of girls on the continent, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Skype with Nanundidu. She is the Regional Advocacy Policy and Research Advisor for Plan International in East and Southern Africa. She began by talking about how African girls were faring before the COVID-19 pandemic.
I will say for the last 10 years, there has been significant progress. For example, you see countries like Sudan, which with the new government now setting up an anti-FGM law that makes it prohibited for girls in the country to undergo female genital mutilation. Activists across the country, both nationally and internationally, have sought legal measures by the Sudanese government to protect girls. As you may know, legal policies are always as good as they are implemented. But we're seeing a lot more hope for girls to be better protected.
What about Southern Africa?
Southern Africa is a region that has been gravely affected by early child marriage. But countries in the region have been working around a legal process that enforces prohibitions against child marriage. And now you're seeing a lot of progress in Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe. But it is quite widespread in countries like Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, especially in contexts where they're poverty-stricken and or they're in conflict or crisis.
What about progress for African girls in the sphere of education?
Education has been mixed, even with increased access across the continent. In some countries, you're seeing, for example, issues around menstrual hygiene that are continuing to bar girls from sustainably going into their schools.
Please explain, at least to our male listeners, why menstruation can be an issue when it comes to educating girls.
A couple of things. One is the stigma around menstruation, especially for younger girls, that stops them from being open about it. And for a lot of girls, especially in rural areas, access to sanitation products becomes a challenge, where the outreach of international actors or government control is limited. And these girls traditionally have very limited access to water, and that is vital during girls' menses. So the girls miss out on school on certain days of the month, therefore really pulling them back in their learning and development.
What about the issue of gender-based violence?
Many countries continue to experience high levels of gender-based and sexual violence. But in the context of COVID-19, the continent has seen quite an upsurge in sexual violence. One of the reasons is that young girls are often now confined in the same spaces with their abusers, and therefore increasing their risk to sexual violence. We are also seeing, because of restrictions, either lockdowns or social distancing or things like that, a lot more frustration resulting in physical violence, and that is targeted at who are considered the weaker sex. And girls are unable, because of the restrictions, to report on these cases.
And of course, the pandemic makes it much harder for you and other NGOs to monitor the extent of the violence against girls and to help them.
Yes. What I often say is that we will only know the true impact of the violence and the protection challenges way into the pandemic in this region, and it may not be a really good picture.
On the positive side, they say that Rwanda has become a relatively enlightened place for girls and women. Do you agree?
I think so. Rwanda has done a good job in demonstrating actual practice, bears some vision of what is possible.
So on this year's International Day of the Girl, you're both optimistic and concerned.
This is a journey. We are learning as we go, but it's a journey that will take a long time to address. I think we've moved many steps ahead from where we were, but then we need to make sure that girls themselves are part and center of this entire conversation. It is well and good for adults to speak about girls, but they hold aspirations that we need to account for as we work with them.
That was my colleague Adam Phillips speaking via Skype with Nanundidu of Plan International. The United Nations World Food Programme has won the 2020 Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts to combat hunger and food insecurity around the globe. Executive Director David Beasley said on Twitter, the agency is deeply humbled by the announcement. He added that it is an incredible recognition of the dedication of the WFP family working to end hunger every day in more than 80 countries, many of them in Africa. Spokesman Thomas Pierre says the WFP not only provides food for today and tomorrow, but also equips people with the knowledge and the means to sustain themselves for the days after that. He added that the WFP not only provides food aid to millions worldwide, but it also handles logistics for the overall UN organization, especially in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. The Nobel Committee made the Peace Award announcement earlier today. There were 318 candidates, 211 individuals, and 107 organizations. The winner, WFP, gets $1.1 million cash award and a gold medal. Inspirational young people from Burundi, Malawi, Nigeria, and Tanzania are designing solutions to help their communities confront COVID-19. More than 80,000 youths aged 14 to 35 have taken part in the COVID-19 Design Innovation Challenge for UNICEF via CartDo, an experimental learning platform that helps young people develop employability and entrepreneurship through innovation challenges. Mavis Ochera reports.
COVID-19 has drastically changed the lives of young people living in Africa, where those under 35 make up 75% of the population. Nigeria piloted the Global Challenge in May, inspiring a wave of youthful participants across the continent. They explore the human needs related to the pandemic, then channel their findings into solutions that ordinary people in their communities can use. Sam Maskini, founder of the Inspire Offline mobile learning app, which was created to make e-learning work in the face of low digital literacy and poor infrastructure in Malawi, says COVID-19 has further disrupted his country's educational sector. He says only 35% of children in Malawi get to complete their primary education and just 8% finish secondary education. He says the offline learning app seeks to provide access to educational content and resources to over 2.7 million secondary school students and around 1.3 million secondary school dropouts in Malawi. He says about 85% of Malawians do not have internet access, and the offline mobile learning app would be convenient for youth to study amid the pandemic.
We're making it simple in such a way that the application will be running on a basic mobile phone, and it will host or it will contain the Malawi's National Schools Curriculum. So we are providing this opportunity to the youth of Malawi, wherever they are located, so that they can access relevant learning resources to either supplement the learning or continue the learning whilst in their homes.
He says the idea was to reimagine education and offer equal opportunities for a school-aged child in a remote village and a privileged urban child with high-end devices.
The solution was inspired by my past experience attending community development schools and knowing that not every Malawian youth has the same privilege as those in the urban areas or ones in private schools that can easily enroll in an online learning platform for an inclusive education for all.
Maskini says the challenge he anticipates in using the app is access to reliable power supply and mobile phones in rural areas. UNICEF is working with partners to expand education, training, and employment opportunities for young people aged 10 to 24 through Generation Unlimited, a global multi-sector partnership including government, multilateral organizations, civil society, private sector, and young people. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Sotri in Ghana.
A man who was found not guilty in Kenya's Westgate shopping mall terror attack attack case was abducted Thursday on his way home. Local media report says that Liban Abdullahi Omar was in a taxi with his sisters when unknown gunmen stopped the vehicle and abducted him. The men put him in their vehicle's trunk and took away the keys of the taxi. His lawyer, Mbugai Bureti, told the Associated Press news agency that the men identified themselves as security agents. The police have declined to comment. Omar was among three men tried on charges of aiding Somali militants who attacked Nairobi's Westgate Mall in 2013, which left at least 67 people dead. A court acquitted him on Wednesday in the case, but the two co-defendants were convicted. Truck drivers carrying commercial cargo are experiencing long delays at the Bete Bridge border post tied to restrictions imposed to fighting COVID-19. The border is an exit point for truckers carrying commercial goods into neighboring countries. Adegando gives us more on the story.
Commercial trucking operators say that they've been experiencing delays of up to 4 days in clearing cargo across the border at the Bete Bridge border post. The delays began at the start of October when South African authorities imposed new clearance procedures under its COVID-19 restrictions. In addition, South African border authorities temporarily stopped trucks from other countries and then the Southern African Development Community if they lack clearance documents from their home country. The resulting pandemonium led to the easing of the measures, although drivers and cargo must still undergo health screening and physical checks. But the chaos continues. Transporters blame other problems such as staff shortages, a malfunctioning weight bridge, and a cumbersome vehicle inspection process. Mike Fitzmaurice is with the Federation of East and Southern Africa Road Transport Associations, FESATA, which represents national road transport associations in 14 Southern African countries. He says the delays have cost his members millions of rands since October 1st.
Not all agents and transporters have representation after 8 p.m. at night. The potential losses are huge. And for every hour lost at Bytebridge, it costs the industry around 300 rand per truck. Based on the current volumes at Bytebridge of 1,000 trucks per day, it is costing the cross-border transport industry approximately 300,000 per hour.
Joseph Msariri, the chief executive of the Shipping and Freight Forwarders Association of Zimbabwe, confirms that the bottleneck continues at the Bytebridge border post. He says the problem is worsened by drivers seeking to circumvent stringent controls at the Botswana border.
Northbound traffic trucks are taking about 3 days on the African side and then another day on the Zimbabwean side, which makes a total of 4 days to cross a northbound. And normally that would take about 2 days.
Msariri worries the chaos is creating a potential health hazard because of the crowding that is taking place. Fitzmaurice says there's been little progress by either South African and Zimbabwean port authorities in resolving the delays. Bytebridge border post has become an exit point of choice within the region for trucks within the SADC region since the imposition of lockdown regulations in March. More drivers are traveling through Zimbabwe now to avoid tighter pandemic controls at the Botswana border.
It's not really an option because Botswana do not accept negative COVID-19 certificates from other countries, and they insist on testing every driver that comes through, and then he has to be quarantined until the results are available, and then once the results are available, he's allowed to proceed to the exit border.
And Fitzmaurice acknowledged that drivers have some responsibility for the problem if they do not have complete documentation. Both authorities on both sides of the Bytebridge entry point did not respond to requests for comment. Trucking operators say officials in the 16 SADC governments need to work together to find ways to both fight the pandemic and move cargo to stop the economic bleeding in the region. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegondo in Bulawayo.
The Commission of Inquiry into Corruption in South Africa has issued a summons for former President Jacob Zuma to appear before it. Zuma has refused to appear before the commission, accusing its head of being biased against him and demanding that he recuse himself. But the commission says he must appear without fail. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In delivering the order at the commission space in Johannesburg, commission chair Judge Raymond Zondo gave Jacob Zuma only two options. The former president can choose to appear in person at 10 a.m. daily from November 16th to the 20th, or he can appear through video link if he thinks physically appearing will expose him to COVID-19. Judge Zondo has made it clear that all other avenues to get Zuma to appear had been exhausted.
Whether you make a request nicely, he won't file an affidavit. Whether you reach an agreement with him and he undertakes to file an affidavit, he won't file it. When I issue a directive in terms of the regulations, he did not file an affidavit within the time that was given.
Over 30 witnesses who appeared before the commission have implicated the former president in a variety of corruption allegations. The allegations include that he dismissed ministers who resisted corrupt deals. It's also alleged he gave directives that led a number of state-owned enterprises to lose millions of dollars. The commission's lead counsel, Paul Pretorius, says the summons leaves Zuma with no other option but to present himself for questioning.
You, as the commission, have the power of a court of law to compel attendance by way of summons. So that's a statutory power that you have, and it's a power equivalent to that of the High Court.
Zuma and his lawyers did not attend Friday's hearing, but in a letter written in response to the invitation for Zuma to attend, they made it clear he will no longer be part of the commission's proceedings until Zondo recuses himself. Zuma is also questioning the legality of the commission, which he himself set up after the courts compelled him to do so. Supporters of Mr. Zuma protested outside the commission venue, vowing to ensure that he does not appear before Zondo. The commission is expecting to finalize its work in March next year. Zuma was president for almost 9 years until his African National Congress Party forced him to resign in 2018 over corruption allegations. He has denied all such allegations. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.